Stock with Susan Hayes Cullerton.
With Nifty Business, the fleet management specialists. Keeping your business fleet moving with service you can count on.
This is News Talk.
Welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton, and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Coming up on today's programme, are today's 20-somethings economically worse off than their parents were at their age? With the EU presidency almost among us, what opportunity and related costs does it present to Ireland? Plus, with the rise and rise of the tech sector in the stock market, and particularly with SpaceX's meteoric rise, is diversification dead in passive investing? You can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you could message me on socials at Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, for my explainer this week, I wanted to pick up on the development of Kevin Warsh's first Fed meeting on Wednesday. Because in anticipation of the meeting, the Globe and Mail had this quote. Warsh has said he dislikes forward guidance about monetary policy in general, and the continued run of strong data has prompted many officials to say it is time to remove the easing bias anyway, in favour of more neutral language that allows for the possibility that rate hikes might be needed. Now, let me decode this. First, forward guidance is public communication, where a central bank clarifies its intentions really for future monetary policy around interest rates, etc., based on how the economy develops. But Kevin Warsh says he dislikes this, and so it will be interesting to watch the future of forward guidance. And also an easing bias. Now, that is when the markets are expecting rates to be cut, and that would be to stimulate the economy. And more neutral language is where we have fewer expectations of what's likely to happen before any data is even received, which would influence decision-making. Now, last year, the world questioned the independence of the Fed. So if we put all of this together, based on what Kevin Warsh says he likes, and based on what the Fed data is saying and how the market is reacting, let's just see how this term goes. Now, SpaceX has been leapfrogging behemoths like Berkshire Hathaway and Amazon to become the fifth largest company a couple of days after it was listed. And of course, then there was lots more volatility that came after that. However, when you look at the composition of the large index funds now, I feel it's important to ask if diversification is dead for passive investors. I'm delighted to be joined now by Jack Delaney, Senior Multi-Asset Portfolio Manager from Irish Life Investment Managers. So first off, Jack, will you take us through what is passive investing and who does it?
So passive investing is a type of investing where the sole goal of the fund is to deliver returns in line with a particular index. So you might have an index like the S&P 500, which just represents the largest 500 companies in the US stock market. What a passive fund that tracks the S&P 500 does is it invests in line with the index. It holds the same companies in the same weights. And in doing that, it delivers returns for investors in line with the overall index. Now, who uses it? There's lots of different use cases, and passive investing has really exploded in popularity over the course of the past number of years, and in fact, over the course of the past few decades. But really, it's seen as a low-cost, efficient way for investors, be they institutional or individual, to get a diversified, broad exposure to a wide pool of assets.
And there we go. Low-cost, yes. And efficient, yes, because instead of buying lots of different stocks, particularly all 500 of the S&P 500, I can buy one fund and I get exposure to them all. But the diverse bit is what I want to talk to you about now, because when we look at the composition of the S&P 500, it's really heavily weighted towards tech these days. And given the rise and rise of SpaceX, now I know it's been volatile since, but all the same, if one is buying something like the S&P 500 to be diverse, are they really doing that anymore?
This is a really important question, I think, when it comes to investing right now. And I think if we kind of just take a step back and think about what's developed in markets over the course of the past number of years, one of the key themes that we've seen in markets has been, as you say, the kind of the dominance of technology as a theme, the dominance of technological companies. So over the course of the past few years, you know, you've seen this increase in concentration as the large tech companies have performed very, very well. So the companies like the Googles, the Amazons, the Microsofts and so on, more recently, the tech companies that play really nicely into the artificial intelligence theme, which has been one of the key drivers for markets over the course of the past three and a half years. What I think about the level of concentration in those indices right now is it's largely a kind of a feature as opposed to a bug per se. And what I mean by that is the reason for the increase in concentration that we've seen, it's because those companies have performed very, very well. They've delivered very significant growth in their profitability, and the market's kind of rewarded that by increased share prices over the course of the past kind of 3.5 years, as I say. That's been a really good place, frankly, for investors to be as that concentration's increased. They've had great exposure to this theme that has continued to support markets. I think the question then becomes, as we look at it right now today, is that concentration becoming a problem for investors? As you say, are they still getting that level of diversification that they might traditionally come to expect from a passive approach to investing?
You say that it's an interesting question and it's an important thing to consider, but what is the answer to this then? I mean, is the reality that people who are now buying something like a broad-based index fund actually taking a very active position where they're backing the tech sector and they possibly don't even know it?
So when we look at the tech sector, it is a bigger portion of the index. So you look at kind of the US equity index, it's 30-40% of the index is to that tech sector. Okay, so it is significant. Now, what I think it's important to note is when you look at the companies that have become bigger shares, they remain very profitable companies. They remain companies that have strong underlying fundamentals. The Magnificent Seven, this kind of benchmark of big US tech companies, it's expected to grow their earnings by 34%. This year. Okay, so the fundamentals for those companies, they do remain strong. If we think about the theme that supported those companies, it has been artificial intelligence and the broader tech theme that we mentioned. And I do think that theme has further to run.
But the thing though is, Jack, people who are buying exchange-traded funds or index funds, they don't or shouldn't be needing to think about themes if they're looking for broad-based exposure. This is the point, is that are they now into a more active decision-making process by virtue of the fact that they're buying a broad-based ETF, but fundamentally it's coming down to the fundamentals, literally, of a couple of sectors?
They are more exposed to that theme, but equally that theme is making up a bigger portion of the economy as well. So is it an active decision that they're taking, or would it be an active decision to do something else? That's the kind of the question that I think is at play here. The other thing that's worth mentioning, though, and kind of coming back to this idea of diversification, that theme in terms of the concentration of technology, it's particularly pertinent in the US. And I think there are ways for investors who want to build in some additional diversification by thinking about options outside the US, thinking about global equity exposures, thinking about opportunities in other regions, be that emerging markets. Now, they have benefited from artificial intelligence as well. About areas in Europe, for example, there's some interesting areas there. So, you know, there are options for investors who do want that additional diversification beyond what you can get in some of these indices. But at the same time, I don't think we should be looking at the level of concentration as a very, very pronounced problem because of the degree of underlying profitability that these companies continue to display.
Can I ask you about where all the money that is being spent on AI is actually going? Who are, as we call them, the CapEx receivers? Who or where in the market or the economy should we be looking at as the second derivative of that AI play beyond the tech companies? Like, is it the financials who are now earning fees? Is it the companies who are building infrastructure? Who is it? Like, who's getting all the money that all of these tech companies are spending on AI?
Right. So I think when we think about AI, multiple phases are going to kind of play out here as we see this build out. We've seen the first phase, which is kind of these hyperscalers, the NVIDIAs, who are kind of building out this capacity. Second phase then answers your question, who's getting all that capital expenditure? And what we've seen in recent months is this pronounced rotation towards kind of hardware, infrastructure, semiconductors, companies who are providing the underlying core building blocks that's necessary for that AI capacity. So if you look at some of the kind of the specific names in that space, Micron, it's a US semiconductor company, experienced enormous growth, 750% growth in their share price over the course of the past year. They were trading at around $150 billion company a year ago. They're now a $1 trillion company in the space of just 1 year. SK Hynix, it's a Korean semiconductor company. They've experienced returns of over 900% in the past year. So we're starting to see this bit of a rotation. It's still AI, but it's towards the second phase, which is the market identifying those beneficiaries, those receivers, as you say, of that capital expenditure. And we've seen tremendous performance from subsectors there like semiconductors.
So who are we not paying attention to, Jack?
So I think this is where the interesting bit comes. And this is kind of...
Only now!
The phase... well, it's all interesting, right? But this is where phase three comes. And I think where we're eventually going to get to is the beneficiaries of artificial intelligence broadening out much more widely. So we've been talking about how the benefits have accrued quite narrowly so far, the hyperscalers, the semiconductors, but I think we're eventually going to get to a world where you see more and more companies across multiple sectors, in no way limited to tech, profitably incorporating artificial intelligence into their business models, identifying ways to utilize AI to increase revenues, to increase productivity, to reduce costs, and ultimately to grow their earnings. That's a space where I think we're going to see AI act as much more of a leveler in terms of the overall playing field, as opposed to a boost to a kind of a small handful of companies. Now, we're probably maybe 1 or 2 years away from seeing that really kind of take off in a meaningful way. But I think what's interesting is, when we come back to the point about index investing, it's very, very difficult to say which companies are going to be able to do that the best. Who's going to be able to figure out the most efficient ways to capture the benefits of artificial intelligence? But taking a diversified approach and allocating to the overall index, as opposed to trying to handpick a few different companies, is actually quite an efficient way to make sure that you do capture those winners without having to be too particular about identifying exactly who they're going to be.
I would agree with you on many of the things that you would say. On the ground, though, my experience is that smaller companies can implement AI more quickly than bigger ones due to size, scale, regulation, public scrutiny. Could it actually be the case that listed companies might be more laggards in implementing that type of operational excellence you're talking about by virtue of just how big and protected they are in comparison to the real economy?
I think it's possible. Right. I think there are certain benefits to being a small company, a nimble company. You can make these changes more quickly.
But investors can't invest in them.
Well,
not publicly. Anyway.
Not publicly, you know, notwithstanding the move towards more initial public offerings that we are seeing in this space. But without going there in too much detail, I do think we're going to get to the point, though, where this it's not optional. And I do think we are going to see large companies make it happen in terms of the need to really incorporate this. If everyone else is doing this, if we're in this arms race, I don't think companies can stay back and say, I'm just too bureaucratic, I'm just too inefficient, I can't make these changes. So I do think we'll eventually get to that point, as I say, not tomorrow, not next month, but over the course of the next year or two, where we can see more companies start to make those changes and start to reap the benefits of AI in a much broader way.
I've been watching earnings calls, as listeners of Taking Stock will know. I've been watching these for years now, and every company for the past couple of years have talked about the big bets they're making in AI. What I think the market will become more scrutinous about is how is that translating into the bottom line. To pick up on your point, and even the point that you're making there, though, means that as investors, we need to be sharpening our own point of view as well to hold companies to account in that regard. It sounds like that's what you're saying.
Yeah, I think we're already seeing the market become a little bit more discerning, right? So you've seen a few wobbles, a few bits of volatility about, you know, the market being concerned about certain companies almost spending too much or maybe not backing up that spending with kind of underlying profitability. We've seen the SaaSpocalypse earlier this year where we all started worrying, you know, what if AI is so good that it fundamentally disrupts the business models of these big software providers? So we're starting to see the market kind of discern what it does like and what it doesn't. But longer term, you know, as we see that theme broaden out, I do think it's going to act as this kind of rising tide that lifts more and more boats. And index investing is no bad place to be if you want to capture that broadening out of the theme.
The last thing I want to ask you is about index composition, because the S&P 500 is market cap weighted, which means the bigger the size of the business, the bigger the weight that it has in the index. But the equal weighted S&P 500 so far this year has actually been performing slightly better based on the numbers that we're seeing this week. So when you talk about index composition or index investing, do you encourage people to not just think about, well, which geography do I want, but actually how do I want to expose the money that I have to the weights of the companies? Or do you think, look, the bigger the better?
I think that the great thing about index investing is that it gives people choice, right? There's whole hosts of flavors of indices, be they market cap weighted indices, like you've mentioned, the bigger the company, the bigger the weight, equal weighted indices, factor-based indices and so on. The world is your oyster when it comes to index investing. But I agree, like there's so much focus on these large tech companies. But if you actually look at it, again, let's look at the S&P 500. Mag 7 projected to grow earnings at 34% this year. The other 493 companies are expected to grow at 13%. Now, when you put 13% beside 34, it doesn't sound great. But if you look at history, annual earnings growth has been kind of 7 or 8%. So even these companies outside the Mag 7 are growing their profitability almost twice as fast as we've seen historically. So you're seeing some great success stories there. outside of these big tech names. What exact way a particular investor wants to get that exposure, you know, equal weight or market cap weight, I think there's choice there, as I say. But the key point for me is, you know, we are seeing strong fundamentals across the whole index. Yes, we're seeing some concentration, but we're not as reliant for profitability on those major companies as we have been in recent years.
What I'm hearing you say, Jack, is there's actually more to run in this AI investment, particularly as we move into getting more discerning about how companies are using it, that the greater concentration in the index is actually representative of the greater spend in the economy anyway. And the third thing is that a lot of the market is doing well, even the areas, the sectors that aren't getting as much attention as otherwise. It'll be interesting to see how this moves on, as you say, with the IPOs and otherwise. But thank you so much indeed for joining me here and taking stock today. Jack Delaney, Senior Multi-Asset Portfolio Manager from Irish Life Investment Managers. This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. Up next, we discuss the economics of the EU presidency. You're welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, for my trivia this week, here are three clues, and let's see if you can pick out which county I was in last weekend. One of the band members of Amble is from here. The first roundabout in this county had to be paved in a perfect circle on the way into the city around a megalithic passage tomb to avoid destroying it. And the coastline here has been ranked as the fourth best location in the world for big wave surfing. Where was I? I will give you the answer at the end of the show. Now, in just a few days' time, on July the 1st, Ireland takes the reins of the EU as it will hold the presidency for the next 6 months. But what does that mean? Is it just loads of meetings taking place in Ireland, or can we as a country actually shape the direction of the EU during this time? Now, I'm delighted to be joined by Seana Murray, the European Affairs Correspondent with Euronews. Seana, this is our eighth time doing this. What has been our track record on previous occasions?
Well, pretty good, actually. Two stand out the most. The one in the early 2000s, which was the big party in Orso Nuctrum, when 10 new countries joined the European Union. That was the biggest splurge in enlargement. There was huge political euphoria because some of these countries had been locked under oppressive regimes through the Soviet Union for many years. And suddenly they were members of the European Union. They were going to enjoy a future of democracy and progress and, an auspicious time in relation to their economies. There was also the 1990 presidency that Ireland have, which was in the immediate aftermath of the fall of the Berlin Wall, where Ireland put as one of its priorities the reunification of Germany, West and East Germany. And that was something that has resonated with Germans for decades. Even to this day, Germans will talk about that presidency and that priority from Ireland, because actually not everyone wanted to. Margaret Thatcher, who was Prime Minister of the UK at the time, wasn't that enthusiastic, but Charlie High said, no, this is something that is good for Europe and we'll be doing it, obviously taking into account the problems ongoing with Ireland and its split at the time. So that was the sort of issue there. But yeah, so we've had some good presidencies. The last time we had it in 2013, we were sort of still emerging slowly from our own bailout and the banking debt crisis and the serious problems that we had with the property bust. So we were sort of trying to reclaim our image and our reputation and our credibility.
As we now move towards 2026, the Taoiseach this time is Micheál Martin, as you mentioned. In 1990 was Charlie Haughey, in 2004 would have been Bertie Ahern. There's been a lot of talk, particularly driven by Micheál Martin and Helen McEntee and a range of people across the cabinet, around competitiveness, values and security. What does this really mean to the man and woman on the street, Seana?
Well, competitiveness is key because there is an acknowledgement that the European economy is flailing, it's floundering. We've had several warnings from leading European politicians, including Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, who said that, you know, the European way of life is mortal and it could die. Similar predictions from Mario Draghi, the former Prime Minister of Italy, who wrote the now famous Bible, essentially, here in Brussels, called the Draghi Report, which talks about the hundreds of billions of euro per year that needs to be invested into the European economy and how Europe needs to become more competitiveness because it's too bloated. And also that we've lost track when it comes to things like the AI race, the sort of the new industrial revolution, when it comes to green tech and various other new technologies. He's making the point that Europe needs to also tighten up the single market, making it much more functional. So those issues do matter because they directly affect the economy, although they are filled with a lot of jargon. Similarly, defence is a big issue. It's not so much where, you know, a discussion in Ireland. But if you are on the border with Russia, or if you're Finland with a 1,350 kilometre border with Russia, or if you're in the Baltic countries, which in the, you know, in living memory was living under a Soviet regime, and you're every day dealing with drone incursions or various types of hybrid warfare on your border and within your territory, then defence is a big issue. Those countries are, spending 5-6% of their GDP on defence. So that is something that is a priority in this EU budget, which Ireland will be chairing the negotiations for.
Isn't there an irony around that then?
Well, no, because Cyprus, for example, is got the presidency right now, and that's not in NATO. It's also a non-formally aligned neutral country. Part of its country is also occupied by Turkey. There's no irony in it because the whole idea of the 27 countries is that you support the European Union as a whole. And that includes solidarity for everybody. So Ireland has to have the same solidarity with Spain, which again is geographically dislocated from the Russian border or located in a more advantageous place, whatever you want to look at it. But so Ireland, Spain, Estonia, Germany, Poland, Lithuania, they all have to have the same solidarity. So the idea is that that you work for the union as a whole. And the country that takes on the presidency mantle after us is Lithuania, which does on a daily basis have to deal with Russian incursions. Even last week, senior politicians had to hide in a bunker because of the level of the drone threat. So actually, it's more about a fluidity and everybody recognising that each country has its own perspective and all of that matters.
I think this is going to be a tricky point over the 6 months because of the position of neutrality, because of that sense of solidarity, and of course the relationship with the US, the changing relationship between the US and NATO. I think this is one we'll be looking at. And just speaking of, though, the number that I've come across, Shona, and I don't know how accurate one can be on this, but the aim I see is that the whole presidency could cost about 300 million and about a third of that spent on security. I don't want to be so crass as to ask, you know, is hosting this a good return on investment for the taxpayer?
Well, I think that is definitely, I know the point you're making because people look at it like that, but it's not a transactional thing. I mean, when you boil things down to transaction about return on investment, that you don't get anywhere. There's no purchase with a conversation like that. You're members of the European Union. Everyone has an obligation to host the presidency. Every country invests in it. It's also a time for every country to shine, to lead, to bring something to the table on an individual basis. Obviously, there'll be lots of visitors to Ireland, but it's not about, you know, what do we get for our euro? Because if everyone thought like that, then what's the point in being involved in any union or any multilateral organization? There's no point in being part of the UN. You know, it's kind of like a Brexiteer sort of mentality that we have to get something that we put in. What we get is as members of the European Union is solidarity from other countries, which Ireland got in spades, by the way, during the Brexit negotiation when all 26 members supported and stood with Ireland during the negotiations with the UK, even though their citizens, whether they're Polish citizens or Hungarian citizens, were in the UK and they wanted them protected. Ireland got full-on solidarity. And not only that, the whole of the mandate for the European Union was focused on protecting the Good Friday Agreement. For about 8 years of the Brexit negotiations, the only focus of the President of the European Commission, the Council, and many others, Michel Barnier, the bureaucrats from Germany, from Austria, from various other countries in the world, they knew more about the borders in Ireland than any single Irish person, I can guarantee it, because of the work that went into that. So it's not just, we shouldn't just think of it as a transactional sense. Maybe, I mean, it's down to Ireland how much they want to spend on it, but there are certain things that have to happen. You invite people over. We'll have, obviously, there'll be Foreign Affairs Council meetings. There will be a big EU summit with all 27 leaders. There'll be the hosting of the European political community, which is 47 countries, including people like Zelensky, Alexander Vucic of Serbia, Erdogan of Turkey. And those things are something that any country should be proud to host, because if everyone took the position that, oh, like, we don't get, you know, money back for it, then what's the point in hosting the World Cup, the Olympics? Like, Macron is hosting the G7 in France right now. You know, you just can't take that position, otherwise you do nothing.
It's an awful pity, Shona, you don't tell us how you really feel.
Well, I just think that sometimes these conversations boil down to something for which the actual proper detail you know, doesn't really emerge when you just start talking about pounds and pence. And I just think that that is something that got lost on the Brits during the Brexit debate. They just wanted to know what they were getting out of it, and you just don't get anywhere.
Well, speaking of money, I do want to ask you about the timing of the 7-year budget plan for the EU, because there is going to have to be a focus now. Certainly, it sounds like an increase in defence, the environmental agenda, also what the report that you had referred to earlier, namely the Draghi report, talking about decarbonisation and digitalisation. How important is it that the EU presidency is happening in Ireland at the time that these crucial sorts of decisions are being made for not just the next couple of months, but the next couple of years when it comes to where money is being spent?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big job. Because the Cypriots started off the negotiations because basically there's a consensus in Europe that the EU budget has to be reduced fairly dramatically because each country is spending much more on certain things, particularly around defence. So they don't want to put as much money into the EU budget, even though the EU itself is actually a good vehicle for defence because of joint procurement and so on. But anyway, the consensus amongst member states is that the Cypriots haven't done a satisfactory job so far. Now, they've done a great job on so many other things, but member states aren't happy with what the Cypriots have put proposed for the budget. So they are. It's now down to the Irish, which will start off in a couple of weeks. And so that will be a hugely important matter to get signed off by November, which is will come to the end of our presidency, because the EU budget kicks in the end of 2027. So it'll really need to be signed off, and a lot of the details will have to be worked out by the end of November. That will be very tricky. The negotiations for the EU budget are the most contentious by far, bar nothing. I remember during last time's EU budget negotiations, the kind of final talk started on a Saturday, and I think we finished on a Wednesday. So they go down through the night to the wire, and there's lots of disagreements. And Ireland obviously will want to protect certain interests in relation to CAP and so on. So Ireland will have its interests played at the table, but it'll also have to have another hat, which is a neutral observer and a facilitator for all member states to collaborate and converge on one issue.
There is another big issue, though, that is facing the EU, which is AI. The EU has seen around the world as wanting to regulate AI, and we've discussed the EU AI Act in the show in the past. Tech innovators want to drive on, as you sure you're looking at, the same as the rest of us, the IPOs around the world that are being discussed around this area. Ireland is going to host an AI summit as part of this with 1,500 delegates. How does Ireland navigate this, given the fact of all of the foreign direct investment in our backyard?
Yeah, I mean, that is a question that it's always facing Ireland anyway, given that we do have all those companies in Ireland. And it's the same when it comes to other matters in relation to trade because of our vulnerabilities towards the US economy. We're always the ones who are very hesitant about taking any action against the US when they're imposing tariffs sort of willy-nilly. But, you know, Ireland will, I don't think it'll be it won't be particularly difficult because of the presidency. In addition to that, because the Commission is the one that sort of creates all this legislation, and the Irish Commissioner is for Justice is Michael McGrath, the Commissioner, EU Commissioner for Justice is an Irish Michael McGrath, and he deals with things like digital markets, not necessarily the regulation of AI, but part of it will be to do with that. And he has a good relationship with those tech companies. He visits and meets them all the time. So I would say that Ireland's in a better position in some ways because they have a relatively good relationship. But at the same time, the overarching priority has to be the protection of democracies, of children, of businesses when it comes to the misuse of AI. And that also means staving off pressure from the United States when it comes to regulation and a lot of these AI companies. And Ireland needs to stay strong in this regard.
There is so much I could ask you about, including the possibility of Montenegro joining as part of a mini EU enlargement, a big contrast of 2004, of course, Seana. There's the focus on online safety. There's the tour of Ireland. There's the leader summits that you spoke about. There is so much that I would love to talk to you about, but I'm right up against it in terms of time. Delighted that I had the chance to talk to you today. Seana Murray, the European Affairs
Very
Correspondent
welcome.
From Euronews. This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock and News Talk. After the break, we question if 20-somethings or their parents when they were 20-somethings were better off. Welcome back to Taking Stock on News Talk. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, I was listening to Breakfast with Anton last week and I heard this.
In terms of like looking at houses or anything like that, it's so far beyond realms of possibility that don't even give much thought.
It's very, very hard. It is not like it used to be anyway years ago, like when people were able to get their house for, you know, a couple of grand, but now it's half a million for a dog box, you know?
I was looking at it with my partner. I'm 26, he's 27. We're looking maybe into our late 30s at this point. If we keep our jobs, but layoffs are crazy. I know I've been laid off twice, and so it's very hard.
And I thought it was something worthwhile to have a really deep dive into the question, are today's 20-somethings economically worse off than the generations that came before them at their own respective age? And joining me here in studio to shed light on the subject is economist Austin Hughes. First of all, Austin, how do we even compare a like-for-like comparison when we're comparing generations economically?
I don't think we can. To borrow and butcher that phrase, the past is a foreign country and we do measure things differently there. You know, the reality is that the current crop of 20 to 30-year-olds are concerned about housing significantly, about the threat of AI, about job security, about a very uncertain world. Whereas the crop of 20 to 30-year-olds who exited the 80s and into the 90s were concerned about, in many instances, getting out of Ireland because it had been written off as an economy. So now we're wondering, you know, things are possibly too good to be true for my parents. So, you know, I'm worried about how the future will pan out. Whereas back then it was a case of saying things are going to remain rotten forever. Remember, The Economist magazine, the late 80s, famously had a front page leader on the Irish economy. The poorest of the rich showed someone begging on O'Connell Street Bridge and basically said, this economy is a write-off. And that was a prevailing view back then. The population was falling in the late 80s. We were the last country in Western Europe until, I think, about 1995 that had net outward migration. So it was a very different economy, very different focus. We had, you know, much poorer living standards. We had higher unemployment. So in that regard, it was a very different place. And The Economist, you know, the straightforward economics 101 would say that things were, you know, dramatically worse then and that we have seen, you know, unbelievable progress in the interim. But that doesn't remove the anxiety and uncertainties, and it doesn't move the precarious nature of a lot of economic activity at the moment. So it is a very different set of circumstances. But, you know, now someone in their 20s and 30s is coming into a much richer economy, the much lower unemployment rate. They've much better job prospects than they had back then. They have probably much greater prospect of living a good deal longer, of inheriting a great deal more wealth, but they're still anxious about job security, about what the next shock to the system is going to bring.
I wonder whether it all really boils down to the ability to get a house. And I don't mean just buy one, but rent one. And if there's one place that I'd like to uncover within the economy as well, when you compare and contrast, in 1986, women made up approximately 32% of the labour force in Ireland, then Austin. And when we look at it today, women account for 41.7% of full-time employment and 67.1% of part-time employment. Like, the female employment rate has now reached 69.3%. Is a really big structural change to the Irish economy that in a household, two people became an earner. And therefore, when it went to applying for a mortgage, then you had two incomes rather than one. Is that really what has changed? And also, I'm guessing we wouldn't like to reverse.
No, I think that's one very important structural change. But as I say, the other one is the population in general was falling or flattish. It was 3.5 million. Now it's rising dramatically, you know, one of the fastest growing countries in Western Europe. So those circumstances are very different. And in terms of, you know, the implications for house prices, obviously, you know, the house price in 1990 was around 65,000, you know, 1995, 30 years ago.
And that was punts,
under,
of course.
80,000.
That was punts, if we're going back to 1990.
That's in euro terms, right?
Okay, yeah.
Now we're talking about the, you know, the new house price for 2025, according to CSO numbers, was around 455,000, you know. And in terms of the relationship between earnings, as you say, and house prices, back then, average earnings were a shade under 15,000 in 1990. The average house was about four times earnings. Still the same in 1995. It's now over eight times, depending on how you measure.
And isn't that back to, though, to the point that since you've two people earning in many houses now, is that to a degree household income has simply kept up?
Exactly. You know, and even in terms of average earnings, you know, we've had this other structural change that's been dramatic in terms of housing and other aspects of the economy. We've had a sharp drop in interest rates. You know, the average interest rate through the 80s was, well, there wasn't an average because it was moving quite dramatically. But over the turn into the 90s, it was around 11%. It was still 7.5%. Nearly 8% in 1995. Now it's 3.5%. So you can fund a much bigger mortgage. If you actually look at the ratio of mortgage payments on your 11% interest rate back in 1990, it would have accounted for about 40% of the average industrial wage. By 1995, it was 30. And in 2025, we're talking about 25%. If you take out a 90% mortgage. But of course, another element is that there's been a very significant build up in wealth. So the average mortgage is lower, and the average mortgage as a share, the average mortgage repayments mm-hmm. as a share of the average industrial wage would be about 20%. So those sorts of structural change, but a lot of them centered around, again, the change in the female participation rate. And again, the internationalization of the Irish economy. Remember, you know, the corporation tax regime we have now only started to be phased in 1997. I think it was something like 30-35% corporation tax rate in 1990. Average tax rates were actually higher. You know, the standard tax rate was about 30-33%, and it went up to 50. It's a little bit lower now. Yes, there are other issues, but we have an altogether, we are buying a lot more things. The consumption now today per head is around 30,000. In 1995, in inflation-adjusted terms, it was around 15,000. So we're buying twice as much nearly.
Is it that we're buying twice as much things? Or is it, well, it's inflation-adjusted, so it's not that we're spending the same amount?
No.
Okay, okay.
Inflation, you know, again, there are so many moving parts in terms of this that obviously inflation has gone, the price of some items, housing a particular case, that has changed dramatically. But other items have come down. You know, I'm old enough to remember the standard flight to London being around, I think it was 208 punts back in the late 80s. That'd be somewhere close to 600 euro now, you know.
Open back to market for that now.
Adjusted. So, you know, it's a very different sort of set of circumstances.
Can I bring another structural change to you as well? And that is the average weekly earnings is now 1,000 euro, slightly over 1,074.61 in Q1 2026. But the dispersion around the average earnings now, when you're taking into account foreign direct investment companies who are paying very high wages, and yet we've 45% of our workforce today, Austin, who are earning under 30 grand. Isn't that what's also changed, is the dispersion of the amount that people are earning relative to this theoretical now average?
Yeah, this is a real sore point of mine, that economists tend to talk as though the average explains everything. The reality is circumstances vary so widely. But in terms of that sort of dispersion, a lot of it is part-time. Now, probably in some instances, part-time is forced because of childcare and other sort of issues, commute times, etc. and that. But there is also the option there. It wasn't as freely available in the early 90s. It was more a take-it-or-leave-it economy. And we had an unemployment rate back then of 12%. Long-term employment was about 7%. So lose your job, you could be stuck for a while. Now we're looking, you know, just under 5%. And of that, long-term unemployment is about 1.5%. So yes, there is greater dispersion. And part of that is greater opportunity. You know, there is undoubtedly the scope for someone to set up their own tech business. The group, remember, there was a famous IDA ad that featured in a lot of papers in the early 80s where the young Europeans, and it talked about graduates in terms of the economy. When they looked back at the ad about 7 or 8 years afterwards, all but one of those people in the ad had gone abroad. You know, so very different, hugely different in terms of education. In 1985, we had 56,000 people in third level education. 2023, it's 260 odd thousand or so. So there are more opportunities. Yes, there is more anxiety. There's more uncertainty. We have, you know, the regular shocks, you know, from Brexit to COVID to the war in Ukraine to Mr. Trump's whatever he'll do tomorrow. And we have the threat of AI. But back then, as I say, it was a different threat. We had the deindustrialization of the Irish economy and the sense, can we live with Europe? Now, we got incredibly lucky in that regard. You know, the drop in corporation tax at the same time when globalization was really taking off internationally. So we were very fortunate. You know, maybe the current crop of 20 to 30 year olds are right to say that was the golden time. It's not going to be as good now. But at the same time, maybe, you know, we'll have more entrepreneurs, more exciting AI companies from Ireland over the next 20 years. What is very certain is people are going to inherit a lot more wealth. You know?
And I'd love to talk to you about that on another occasion, because that is becoming more and more, I think, topical. I don't just mean in terms of conversations that we have here on radio, but topical in conversations that are happening around sitting room tables at home. I do want to ask you one last thing. The government is now saying there's 600 houses a week being built. The biggest issue, one might argue, of a young person's time is their ability to get a house. Do you think that the horizon looks more positive for them in the 10 years ahead rather than the 10 years that have gone by?
Yes, in terms of the 10-year view, because certainly 10 years ago, you know, there were economists saying we shouldn't build any more houses because the economy has cratered and will remain cratered. So I think there's a little more positivity there. And remember back in terms of the 1990s, we were building about 20,000, you know, loans, new loans were about 30,000. They were 45,000 last year. So there is progress there. It's slow, it's painful. And, you know, we do need to make sure that the fruits of that are shared. I'd have a different view to a lot of economists about the need to ensure that the social contract is honoured and we don't see a fracture of society.
Well, that the intergenerational wealth transfer then brings up all of those conversations, which we'll have to have you back in, because I'd love to pick up on that with you for sure. Thanks so much indeed for that longitudinal insight, economist Austin Hughes. Now, for the answer to this week's trivia. Earlier on in the show, I gave you three clues to see if you could pick out which county I was in last weekend. One of the band members of Amble is from here. The first roundabout in this county had to be paved in a perfect circle around a megalithic passage tomb to avoid destroying it. And the coastline here has been ranked as the fourth best location in the world for big wave surfing. Where was I? The answer is Sligo. And even more specifically, I was in Enniscrone for my in-laws' annual family reunion. It's always one of the highlights of the summer. So I hope those clues helped you to pick it out. And that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes Culleton. I hope you enjoyed the show and hopefully even learned something about economics and, more importantly, how it shapes the world around us. A quick reminder, the show is available as a podcast first every Friday morning on the Go Loud app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. And please do pop the link into your WhatsApp groups for anybody who might be interested in tuning into us. Taking Stock is also on air here on News Talk every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The series producer of the show is John Fardy, and in this week was Aoife Breen. Research this week was by Stephen Daunton, Ben Sweeney, and Stephen McClune was on sound. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day, and I'll talk to you again next week.
Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Culleton. On News Talk.
With Nifty Business, the fleet management specialists. Helping businesses unlock growth with a leased vehicle fleet.